Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mike Duncan of the History of Rome and Revolutions, David Crowther of the History of England, and Kevin Stroud of the History of English will all be in the same place at the same time at a day devoted to thought-provoking podcast infotainment. On June 29, from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m, the Agora Podcast Network will be presenting the Intelligent Speech Conference at the Norwood Club, Chelsea, in New York City. In addition to Mike Duncan, David Crowther and Kevin Stroud, some of your favourite Agora Podcast Network hosts will also be there, including Royfield Brown of Mid-Atlantic, 10 American Presidents and How Jamaica Conquered the World, Eric Fogg of Reconsider, Steve Guerra of the History of the Papacy podcast, Claude Myron Guza of the Cannonball podcast, Aziz Al-Dori of the History of Westeros podcast, Raven of Tiny Vampires, and Benjamin Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia. With all these amazingly talented individuals, you may be worried that there are too many for one day, but there will be three conference rooms featuring panels, talks, and laser tag. Okay, there will not be any laser tag, but definitely a full day of panels and talks from a dozen of the best podcasters on the planet. But what if you might get hungry? Fear not, good citizen. The $175 tickets include dinner with your favorite podcasters, while the $125 tickets will get into the Norwood Club to participate in the day. You can get tickets to the Intelligent Speech Conference by going to intelligentspeechconference.com. Mike Duncan, David Crowther, and Kevin Stroud live and in person. Simply go to intelligentspeechconference.com.
It was the best of time. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
Little fight on the beaches.
Away, man. These are the things that made England.
Little fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hello and welcome to The Things That Made England. The idea of this show is to decide on what things make England the way that she is, the country that, despite it all, we all feel lucky to be part of. Every week, David and I pitch to each other an idea to be designated as one of the things that makes England distinctive, and it goes into Jennifer's cabinet. Now, David, I've decided this week to choose a topic that is very close to my heart, or I like putting in my tum. Okay. That most English of dishes, curry.
Did you just say in your tum?
Yeah, in my tum.
Did you really just say that? I kind of think of you as this kind of cool, you know, devil-may-care sort of bloke. Using words like tum, just, you know, just doesn't seem right. I'm sorry.
Dave, there is a streak in me, and maybe it's the part of me that connects with you, which is fairly set in the 1930s.
Be careful now.
You know, in a world of black and white movies, you know, and things like talking about me tum, right? It, right. It also just reminds me of being sat on my grandpa's knee.
Okay. But this anyway. Works. We move on now?
I did a gig in Birmingham. I've got to tell you this. The thing that gets me about the people of Birmingham is they seem to think that they invented the curry. Because as soon as you get to Birmingham, we did this gig in Birmingham, they said, no. You can't leave Birmingham unless you've had a curry. They never said it like that. They went, you can't leave Birmingham unless you've had a curry. So you've got to go for a curry. So there's me, my tour manager, and my driver. So we went for a curry. We went to a place called Sandy Lane. We went for a curry. We walked along to this curry house. And it was a Friday night. So we did what every bloke does on a Friday night. We walked in. We ordered the food for 50 starving families. We went, yeah. One of them, or two of them, pop them, some big chips. We want loads of them. Loads of them. And then we got into that thing that you get into. You know, the ego thing. You said, what curry do you want? What curry you want? You have your I want super vindaloo. I want my curry off of this curry. I want the hottest thing you got. In fact, suck the curry. Let me lick the oven. I want to be in agony. At the end of it, yeah. I want to be in pure pain because that's the ego thing that takes over. And we're having all this argument over this curry to get. And then I got asked a question in Birmingham that I have never been asked anywhere else in the world. He said, do you want a naan bread? I said, yeah, we'll have a naan bread. And we got into that naan bread discussion, like, what kind of naan? Do you want raisin naan, chocolate naan, blue naan, Jackie Chan naan, the whole mix? I just said, look, we'll have three naan breads. Three plain naan breads. And then the question came, how big? I said, well, naan big. Three big naans. He said, do you want three family naans? I said, yeah, three family naans. I don't know if anyone has ever had a family naan. If you haven't, go to Birmingham and order one. They are massive. They come out on their own trolley. They're like a duvet made of flour. They come out. We couldn't eat two of them. We took them out to homeless people and wrapped them up. So they
One thing, and I would say, is that I actually came to curry quite late. Being of West Indian parentage, we didn't eat food from the Indian subcontinent kind of growing up. It's only as a teenager that I came to appreciate the delight that is curry. Now, curry, you'll know, is a dish that originates from the Indian subcontinent, and it uses a combination of spices and herbs, normally ground turmeric, cumin, coriander, ginger, and fresh or dried chilies. And of course, the word originates from southern India, and curry is generally prepared in a sauce. Now, because this is such ours now, this dish is ours now, we celebrate.
That's quite a statement. This dish is ours.
It's ours.
Well, it's Indian, isn't it?
We share it with India, but it's ours.
That's good of us, I must admit.
A certain amount of cultural appropriation has gone on, but in the nicest possible way. In the nicest possible way. So we have, every October, there is National Curry Week. That's how embedded this thing is.
Is there? I did not know of National Curry Week.
Yeah, I was aware. You go down the Ladypool Road in Birmingham, which is the main thoroughfare for a quality curry, or quality Balti, actually. And whenever it's National Curry Week, all the signs are there saying, you know, you can have two for one on your tikka masalas, etc., etc. But National Curry Week and Indian restaurants contribute 5 billion, with a B, to the British economy. That's how big
billion pounds worth of curry. That is fantastic. We must go to your, what was the street again?
The Ladypool Road,
right. We must have Things That Made England get together on the Ladypool Road and eat our way down the Ladypool Road.
Nothing would give me greater pleasure. So.
Rather than a pub crawl, we'll have a curry crawl.
We wouldn't get very far if we're going to eat our way down it, unless we had like half a poppadom at each place. There's a lot of curry houses.
Half a poppadom and a curry, please. 3 pints of lager.
As we are going down the Ladypool Road, we're going to see there is one dish that's going to be on every menu, and it's chicken tikka masala.
Is that the one that's invented in Glasgow, yeah?
Well, there's lots of conjecture about that. And we'll come to that later. But chicken tikka masala has been the nation's favourite dish for more than 20 years now. And it has to be said that curry has changed the way that we eat. We haven't just added it to us, so we're not a nation of pie munchers anymore. Now, going way back when, David, the East India Company went to India and founded the Raj in the 17th century. By the 18th century, the East India men wanted to recreate the taste of India back home in England. So by 1733, we have our first recorded public curry.
It was served in
1733. So, and it was served in the Norwich Street Cafe House in Haymarket in London. And this kind of led to curry and rice becoming staples of restaurants in and around London's Piccadilly by the 1780s. The 18th century is also vital in the marination of curry, David, because it was the century that saw the first cookery book containing that Indian recipe in the English language. It was a book called The Art of Cookery Made Plain and Simple by Hannah Glass. It was produced in 1747.
So that general cookery book with curry in it, or book about curry specifically?
No, general book about cooking. It was about demystifying that kind of culinary arts. And within it, it had three recipes of Indian pilau. And later editions had recipes of fowl or rabbit curry and Indian pickle. Today, there are over 30,000 Indian restaurants and takeaways across the UK. But the first purely Indian restaurant was the Hindustani Coffee House, which opened in, guess when?
Hindustani Coffee House, which opened in 1923.
1810.
Hey.
So during the start of the reign of King George IV, and it started serving at 34 George Street near Portman Square in Mayfair. And that's kind of important because a lot of returning East India officers actually lived in and around Portman Square.
Hmm.
The owner of the restaurant was Sheikh Din Mohammed, and he was born in 1759 in present-day Patna, and was then part of Bengal.
Yeah.
And what he tried to do was to provide an authentic ambience with Indian cuisine at the highest perfection. Guests could sit in custard-made bamboo chairs surrounded by paintings of Indian scenes whilst they enjoyed a good curry. But within 2 years, he went bust.
Oh,
basically, he was a man way ahead of
his time. He should have come to Loughborough. It'd have been fine here. We love curry in Loughborough.
Well, I don't know about that. He thought about it, and he thought, we got all these old East India men in around Portman Square. I'll put the restaurant there. The reason why he went bust is because so many of those East India officers could afford their own chefs. So they didn't need to go out and eat.
Oh, God, they had it made in a home.
Yeah, they had it all at home. Now, bankruptcy or not, the old soaks who had lived in India and liked to come back home wearing their Indian clothes, continued to eat the food of the subcontinent. So between 1820 and 1840, the importation of the spiced turmeric, just for one example, which is a primary ingredient in making curry, increased threefold in England. It really shows you, you know, people had their cooks and their chefs actually at home.
So presumably at this point, he said, asking on a pinch point of information, what you're saying is that curry is a posh food.
It's a posh food.
Yeah.
And what we're going to see, the attitudes are going to change in the mid-Victorian era. It's going to fall out of kind of favour, but through Queen Victoria and then through seafarers, it kind of comes back. So this is the first wave of curry, so to speak.
So what you're saying is when the Earl of Watsit goes down and has his curry, he doesn't ask for 8 poppadoms and 3 pints of lager. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. There is a point after the Second World War where beer and curry becomes kind of synonymous. But we haven't quite got there yet, Dave.
Okay, okay.
So, 1857, the year of the Indian Mutiny, or the Bloody Revolt. Now, this changes Victorian attitudes towards India. So, those old East India men were basically banned or at least shamed from wearing Indian clothes in and around London. And so those old East Indian men who had gone native, basically yeah. they're kind of mocked, and that's kind of put away. Curry was removed from fashionable tables throughout London. Though,
so why was that? Because of the rebellion. Yeah,
because of the rebellion. Though the army was still served it. So the army still liked a good old Ruby Murray. Now, there is one member of the British upper classes, or as I said, the aristocracy, who bucked this trend. And that was Queen Victoria. Now, she employed Indian servants, the most famous being Abdul Karim.
Right.
There's been two or three films about his relationship with Queen Victoria. And he impressed Vicky with his chicken curry with dal and pilau. So much so that the British royal family at the end of the 19th century, to have a good curry was their thing. Her grandson, George V, was said to not really have any interest in food at all, unless it was a curry or a bit of Bombay duck. That's the only thing King George V actually truly liked.
I'm exaggerating a little bit, just
a little. But right. he was a man who he liked what he liked, and he didn't like anything newfangled. He grew up eating curry.
Right.
Now, there are many things that are now considered to be typically English which have their origins in Indian cuisine. Piccalilli is one of them, which is an English version of an Indian pickle. And kedgeree, which is obviously a very traditional British breakfast, or so we like to think, but its name belies exactly where it really came from.
We've always assumed it's not English, kedgeree, haven't we?
Well, that's true. But it's seen as quintessentially English, isn't it? But the name does kind of give it away. The name does give it away. I'll give you that.
And the fact that it's made with curry in it.
All right, smart ass. So, but we're saying curry's ours. Yeah.
English is a lardy cake.
Listen, we're saying that English is ours. So yeah. we're at the start of the 20th century. And that's an important time for the second wave of curry because... what you have now are many Indian sailors who have either jumped ship, abandoned ship, or just been dumped by their crews in English ports. And they start to open cafes to cater for other Indians and Asians. Now, for the most part, they're not trained as chefs, but they soon start to adapt their menus to cater for British tastes, which is incredibly important for the dissemination of any cuisine. And I'm always struck... whenever I'm in America and have a Chinese meal, it's very different to a Chinese meal that I have in Britain, and I've never had a Chinese meal in China.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. So you think it's not just there's a sort of westernized Indian food. It's actually much more specific than that. So if I went to Loughborough, I might have a different curry from Stockholm.
Well, absolutely, and there is the point, which we'll come to later, of there is the Birmingham variety, which is the Balsi. So there are subtle local differences. But the whole world does this to cuisines. Mm. So you say to an Italian, put pineapple on a pizza, and they'll shoot you down dead. So well, you wouldn't do such a thing.
With justice, you know? Obviously. So what's fish and chips like in Romania?
Well, I couldn't speak for that. I have been to Bucharest once, but I didn't actually order fish and chips.
Oh, for
though God. I tell you, fish and chips in America is always a letdown because it's fundamentally fries. You know, even if they're a little bit fatter than a regular fry, because
fries is 10 times better than fat chips.
Oh, David!
Come on, nobody likes fat chips. Fat chips suck.
What do you mean, nobody?
No, well, apart from you, then, obviously.
Anyway. I'm at the dawn of the 20th century, the Indian sailors, who were not trained as chefs, started to adapt their menus to cater for the British taste. They also realised, and this is important, that by staying open late, they could earn extra revenue when the pubs closed.
Ah,
so thus, the tradition of the Friday night curry after a beer was founded.
You know, I had to tell you, Roy Field, I know you don't want to interrupt you, I'm getting worried, but like you, I was very late to the curry. And
why are you saying it like that, David?
You cannot say curry in any other way than that you come from Dudley. You have to. There is only a curry. I mean, that, you know, it's the only way to say curry. So I missed out all the way through university. There was one curry house in St. Andrews, which was called the Balaka. Everyone would go there except me because I didn't eat curries. It ruined my university career.
It was an old girlfriend of mine, a woman called Ashley Hazel, who we were together for 3 years during then after college. And she was an aficionado of the curry because she had actually had an Indian boyfriend like a couple of years beforehand. And it was her that opened my eyes. As I said, just growing up, working class Birmingham, black Brummy kid, 70s, 80s, I was aware of Indian restaurants, but it just wasn't something that we did.
I tell you, white middle class family. I mean, as far as my mother's concerned, pasta was this appalling... appallingly exotic foreign import.
It is amazing when you think just how quickly
the world was so much smaller. I mean, you know,
It tastes much more kind of parochial, and it kind of goes to how one of the reasons why I think that curry is so important, because it's a real marker of late 20th century English culture. You know, a beer and a curry. But anyway, let's just finish up with this, because these are a couple of more significant things in the kind of the story of how curry has cemented itself in the English psyche. So by the time of the kind of the middle 20th century in London, we start to have a few kind of famous Indian restaurants opening up. So the Salut e Hind in Holborn and the Shafi in Gerrard Street and the Verasamy opened a 99 Regent Street, which is the first high-end Indian restaurant in the capital. So the start of this second wave of curry starts with these sailors who kind of jumped ship. So you have places like London was a port, then was a dock port, and then like Cardiff and like Liverpool. But really, it's with the post-war Commonwealth immigration to England, and then after 1971. The influx of Bangladeshi immigrants into Britain, that the palate of England is changed forever. You get a deluge then. Many of the Bangladeshi inhabitants, when they came to London, went to the East End. Mm. And so you go to Shoreditch and it's just, you know, you can't swing a cat for an Indian restaurant. And the Bangladeshi immigrants entered the catering business with such fervour that 65 to 75% of all Indian restaurants in the UK are actually owned by Bangladeshis. And today there are more Indian restaurants in Greater London than there are in Delhi and Mumbai combined.
Is that right? What does that say, I wonder?
That we got like a good curry. Now, of course, curry has gone native. I did kind of mention this before. It's as English as the Thames now. Us Brummies, we've created the Balti, a refinement of the basic curry, traditionally cooked and served in an iron cast pot called a Balti pot. It was developed by Kashmiri immigrants to the second city, and it's been simmered in the West Midlands ever since. Curry is such an integral part of English cuisine, so much so that by the late 1980s, chicken tikka masala has been referred to as the English national dish. It's our favourite dish.
Where was it invented then?
Well, okay, the exact origin is not really clear. Now, the Scots do claim that it was a restaurant in Glasgow. I've read that it was a restaurant in Leicester.
Seriously? I always thought it was Brum.
No,
India,
chicken tikka masala. You know. No, it's definitely not India.
So I think it is, you know.
Not so much. Now, the story goes, a bus driver came into an Indian restaurant, coming off work, ordered a chicken curry. He sent it back to the waiter, saying that it was too dry. So the chef added some tomato soup to it and sent it back out. The bus driver absolutely loved it. Within days, it was added to the menu because he came back with his friends. So that either happened in Leicester, some nondescript other bit of England, or possibly Glasgow. Nobody really knows.
What do you mean some other nondescript, as though Leicester was nondescript? Is that what you're saying?
No. I quite like Leicester. It's probably one of those instances where two or three places more or less had the same idea at more or less the same time, and then it's kind of like coalesced. Because it's that whole thing, as we kind of said before, of when cuisines go out into the world, they get localized. And tomatoes added to sweeten the thing with a little bit of cream. Anyway,
Very good.
Other UK derivatives include Coronation Chicken, which of course is
my favourite. My very favourite.
Tell me about it.
Filler.
Exactly, a sandwich filler, which is invented to commemorate the coronation of our Queen Elizabeth II in 1953. And then the final. Well, there are many other kind of curry derivatives, but this dish is incredibly important, I think, because it really symbolises that cross-pollination of East meets West. It's curry sauce or curry gravy on chips.
So when you say East meets West, are you talking about Leicester meets Birmingham then?
That's exactly what I mean. So it's our answer, the English answer to the Canadian dish poutine. It's served with a warm curry sauce, sometimes contains sultanas and some dried fruits over chips. So I put it to you, Dave.
Chips?
Yeah, chips.
What, chips with what?
Curry sauce over chips.
Oh, well, that's true, yeah. Yeah, that's a big favourite in Scotland. So you put it to me
in
that
where?
It's an English thing.
In where? The north of England.
No. Oh, you have apologies to you, the north of England doesn't exist.
No,
it just peters out.
What I said was, after the Lake District, England slowly peters out. And I was talking about the population centres, of which then Ken MacDonald did say, wait on a minute, what about Carlisle?
Carlisle, okay, bang on the border.
I'll give you Carlisle, but after Carlisle, there's nothing else worth talking about.
Anyway, we'll revisit your
anyway, just to end up.
No, Scotland's a big favourite in Scotland, I was going to say. Curry on...
Well,
curry
up north. When I went up north to college, curry on chips, massive. Anyway, as the one-time British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook once said, the national popularity of curry is a perfect illustration of the way Britain, in parentheses, England, absorbs and adapts external influences. I give you curry, sir.
I give you... curry. So there are some crimes associated with curry, of course. You know, I mean, by and large,
really?
I'm on your side. Well, I just have to say to you, I've got two words to you, flop wallpaper.
Well, funnily enough, I was going to insert a little witticism about that very first Indian curry house and basically say the reason why it went bust is because they didn't have the flock wallpaper. Though, to be fair, I can't remember the last time I went to a curry house and there was flock wallpaper.
Yeah, I think we have finally lost the flock wallpaper thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing, of course, is Fat Les.
Vindaloo.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's... oh, actually, I love that. Actually, I must admit, I don't know why I'm thinking that as a crime. So I'm a bit the same with you. I couldn't do curry. I couldn't do the spicy thing. As far as I was concerned, sausage was too spicy. So,
oh, stop it, David.
No,
really?
Seriously. I was terrible because my mother had fed me on boiled potatoes for 20 years. I exaggerate. You know, she was a very good cook, but, you know, it was very English. And I went to Harlow and I had a lamb passanda, which is very, very mild.
Yeah.
And so for
creamy coconut milk, some almonds. Yeah.
Oh, very nice. And so for 15 years, I ate lamb passanda.
Mm-hmm.
And then for another 15 years, I ate chicken tikka masala, pita rice and a naan bread. Oh, and ate papadoms, please. And then I ate something else, a dansak or something. And this is a big moment for me.
So the dansak can be a bit sweet, can't it? A bit of pineapple. What did you have? Was it chicken or was it a bit of mutton? What was it? What type of dansak was it?
I can't remember. But actually, the thing I had was quite hot. So I've got, you know, it's my... taste buds have dropped off my tongue. I've had to go more spicy. So I always sort of thought the saddest thing about curries was if I was, you know, this fine chef, you know, producing these superb dishes with, you know, all these melange of different flavors and all the rest of it. And then a bunch of blokes come in, sink 500 pints of lager, eat loads of poppadoms, wolf a hot curry and then go up boasting about how hot the curry was. It must be a bit depressing, wasn't it? Do you know what I mean? You know, it's like kind of like stoking a steam train rather than feeding people. And then nobody knows the difference between, you know, a northern Indian curry or a Bangladeshi or a southern Indian, you know, all these different variety that you'd get in India, I assume. You know, as far as we're concerned, we'll have a chicken tikka masala and a pilau rice, please. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you kind of slipped there from a bit of Scouse to a bit of the Western Midlands, but I don't know how true that is, right? Because I think one thing which I haven't actually said in this is that Indian restaurants are actually closing at an unprecedented rate. And there's this really interesting article which I read whilst kind of researching this. It's a guy who basically runs the Indian Restaurant Association of Great Britain. Mm. I forget exactly what the acronym is, but it's not exactly, doesn't translate as that, but that's what fundamentally what the body is. And what he said is that British taste buds are changing and are becoming healthier. People still want exotic and exciting foods, but they don't necessarily want heavy foods. And they want much healthier options.
Yeah.
So his thing is that though Indian food is still the most popular cuisine in England, actually in Britain is what he said, a lot of the Indian restaurants haven't moved with the times in terms of cutting down the size of their menus and then also having healthier options. So you can see, you know, very much like if you're a professional working woman and you want to nip out and get something to eat after work on a Friday, you wouldn't go, your first point of call is not going to be a big, fat, heavy curry. However, you still like exciting flavours and you know, new cuisines, etc. So it still are by far our favourite dish, our favourite cuisine, but it needs to adapt with the times, and the industry is having problems because of that, really.
Well, look, I'm very interested. So, of course, I've got the obvious response to this. You know, I'm entirely on your side, as you can tell. You know, Loughborough is very proud of its curries in the 70s. You know, big Asian community, very proud indeed. And, you know, I'm not going to claim that Loughborough was ahead of the curve in terms of race relations. But, you know, it gave a point of contact, which without which, you know, things would have been even harder, I suspect. So I'm kind of on your side. But the obvious thing is, you know, British rather than English.
No, I think we can safely say that the first point of contact when curry hit our shores was actually England. All the documentary evidence was that it was East India officers in London. You know, the cookbook was produced in London. So it very much was an English thing in the first wave.
I'm going to get out of it anyway, because I'm going to, when I come to my next one, I'm going to want to stop you from using the British defence.
Mm-hmm. And then secondly, the second wave has its big kind of points of entry in ports, of which Glasgow is a significant one. I will give you that. But in terms of the distinctness of curry, I would say that it's kind of more English. Though I take the point, and there was actually an MP of Indian descent. I'll say Indian /Pakistani descent, who in 2009 tried to get the EU to declare that chicken tikka masala was kind of native to Glasgow. He did try and do that, but he could never verify that the dish actually came from there. There's a whole load of disputes about it. It's kind of Leicester, it's somewhere else in the UK, but then Glasgow also has a claim as well. But I would say, you look at the genesis of how this quintessentially Indian cuisine has become anglo-sized, and it's primarily done through England.
Right. Okay. Well, look, awesome. I'm prepared to go along with that.
When are we ever going to disagree with each other?
We disagree all the time, but it's all a bit feeble, isn't it? Because you know, we always put things in the cabinet, don't we? You'll have to do something really outrageous. I don't know. Propose something which really isn't English. I don't know. Like, oh, I don't know. I can't think of anything. It's not English now. We're so general.
the imperialist notions.
Borscht is English.
Yeah, we could just say we just like anglicise that down to a regular sausage. You know.
Anyway, never mind. Well, look, you know, it's not necessarily the getting it in the cabinet that's the key thing about this. It's the chance to, you know, celebrate things you love about You know,
true. And I think that's what people seem to like about the things that made England, if you look at the reviews on iTunes. Now, David, shall we see what our great listening public said about the last episode's topic?
Let's do that.
Lovely cup of tea. How very meta it is that the topic of a nice cup of tea has brought harmony to our sometimes fractious group. David and Royfield themselves were unable to raise a storm in a teacup, and for the very first time, we have a unanimous vote on something going into the cabinet. Thinking about it, how could it be any other way? Tea equals England, England equals tea. But the good thing about this group is that while we might all agree on something, this does not mean that we do not have anything interesting to say on the subject. So, what is there to say on the subject? Quite a lot, it would appear, from the commenting by the good burgers of our Facebook group. 177 comments at the last count, and they aren't even all David. A lot of people commented along the lines of Penny, who pointed out how tea fixes everything. Except Brexit, that is. I couldn't agree more. We need a dose of ketamine to get through that one. A few people like Stephen and Marilyn tried to make the point that tea is also big in places like New Zealand and Scotland. But they both still voted it into the cabinet, so there you have it. Melissa and Lonnie had a discussion on what the meal called tea constitutes. I think this is unresolved and dependent, as with so much in this country, on class and maybe also region. We do like Melissa as, even though she is from the Midwest, she has not adopted that monstrosity that is iced tea. All in all, what we have in the group is a wonderful record of the lengths that people will go to get a decent cup of char. There seem to be quite a lot of Americans who, like Leanne, import their tea. She posted a great photo of herself and a bag of PG tips that's about the same size as her. If only we'd known that Americans like importing tea so much. We wouldn't have had that frightful ruckus in Boston back in the day, and you could still all be proud Brits. Wouldn't that be nice? Fortunately, I held back from recording this roundup, as everything was just too lovely, too harmonious. Even our most outspoken commenters were beaten into meekness by the overwhelming power of tea. But then on Thursday evening, it all began to hot up, and David and Royfield bared their competitive streaks. David posted a ranking of the voting for each and every one of the Things That Made England episodes. And it turns out that David's proposals have received stronger backing than Royfield's. Is this because David is better at identifying those things that made England? Or is it, as Alan suggests, that Royfield eschews the low-hanging fruit that David prefers, like the bleeding obvious topic of tea? I, of course, could not possibly comment, but I will leave you all to make your own minds up and encourage you to come over to the Facebook group and chip in on which of our presenters makes the better choice of topics. It's great to see that the membership of our group grows and grows, and while we have some fantastic stalwarts, I would like to take this opportunity to welcome some members who have joined the group in the past couple of months, and we look forward to hearing your contributions. We've had Beck with no K, Dawn with an E, and David with a baby. Jerry with a J, Gareth, who is on the slide, Joe, the 17th of the French Royal House of Blois. A couple of Johns, Meredith, I love the name Meredith, Michael and Mike, who both joined us only last week, and another Michael, who sounds like he might hail from the Danelaw. We've had Pop Art Paul and Paula from San Diego. Penny is mightier than the sword. Philip, great to have an Irishman in our midst. Richard, who will not be the target of any of my weak puns. Purple-haired Sonia. Stefan, not only called Stone, but is actually holding stones in his profile pic. Stephanie, what a hat. Steve putting the great into Great Britain, Royal Tracy, and finally you. Not me, you. Sorry, very poor joke. As ever, thanks to Royfield and David, and thanks to everyone for making the Facebook group such fun.
Thank you for that, Luke. As always, what a great roundup. David, why don't you, considering that I've done the heavy work, the heavy lifting, the intellectual heft of this show has all been me yet again.
Sorry, what
why don't you wrap up and then we can say goodbye and I'll see you again in 2 weeks' time.
Okay, that's very good. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Curry goes in the cabinet along with a chicken tikka masala pilau rice and a naan bread. and a couple of about 10 pints of lager. Thanks for listening, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase.